This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today's national holiday honors Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights leader whose deeds and words roused the conscience of the nation and the world. King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968, 4 years after he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And while that may seem distant history to some, his death and his life remain very real to everyone who was alive at the time, which may help explain the power of the recent controversy about the roles that he and President Lyndon Johnson played in the passage of civil rights legislation. The fact is that neither man's role was simple nor easy to categorize, and that King's relationship with Johnson grew out of his previous dealings with Dwight Eisenhower and John Kennedy. On this Martin Luther King Day, King and the Presidents. Later in the hour, political endorsements are on the opinion page this week. Do you read candidate endorsements in the newspaper, or do you care? You can email us now, talk@npr.org is the email address. But first, Martin Luther King's relations with three presidents, and we begin with a former White House official who joins us here in Studio 3A. Lee White served as an advisor to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. He was President Johnson's chief aide on civil rights matters. And Lee White, good to have you with us again.
Glad to be here.
And let me go back to the Kennedy administration. And when Kennedy came into office, where was Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement on his radar?
Well, the Reverend Martin Luther King was one of the leaders. There were about five or six that constituted the leadership group, and President Kennedy met with them. The principal at that time leader was Roy Wilkins of NAACP, James Farmer of CORE. We had the Congressman John Lewis of SNCC, and Whitney Young of the Urban League. So there was a group, and King was part of that group.
And
he was the leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
And were they seen as, and he in particular, as troublemakers, as allies?
Well, they wanted to go faster than the administration wanted to go on legislation, but President Kennedy's attitude was he could do an awful lot by executive order. And he did do a lot by executive order. He created the Committee on Equal Opportunity and Employment, headed by Vice President Johnson at the time. He created a commission to finally put integration into the armed forces, headed by Gary Gazelle, who later became a federal judge. But legislation was something that we wanted to do later on.
Later on in terms of second term?
Second term, or when the time was ripe. The problem that Kennedy faced legislatively, was that almost all of the committee chairmen, the House and the Senate, were Southerners. They had a habit of keeping their people in office, and the seniority system elevated them to chairmanships. And so it was a little tougher, and it was...
John F. Kennedy was certainly not swept into office by a landslide. He had some political chips, but he chose not to spend them there.
Well, I'm not sure he could have. He'd been successful. There's no point in spending chips if you don't win the game. And he was a pragmatist, of course, and he knew what he could do and what he didn't think he could do. And I think he was correct in the sense that we accomplished an enormous amount. And then, as I think we've already been told, we had the Birmingham explosion in 1963. And that pushed the president's hand, and he was right there on it, gave a powerful speech to the nation about what Bull Connor was doing and with the fire hoses and the dogs, and the issue was joined.
John Kennedy is portrayed, at least in the history books, as somebody who was initially very sympathetic to the civil rights movement, but aloof from it, did not see himself as part of that movement in any stretch of the imagination, and somebody who was made to act, as you suggest, by events rather than forcing the initiative himself.
Well, that's not. I'm not sure where that comes from, because it doesn't quite fit with my own personal experience. He was always for civil rights. That's easy enough. And when the legislation was before him, he didn't have any problem voting for it when he was in the House and in the Senate, although, as you know, there was scanty product produced there. But again, he wanted to. He knew what he could do and what he didn't think he could do, and he didn't want to do that in a manner that was going to jeopardize his other programs.
Mm-hmm. This is, I guess, before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, but did John Kennedy come into office with any sense of obligation to African Americans?
Well, it was this way. That election was so close in 1960 that every group that came in to see him would say, you know, Mr. President, if it hadn't been for us, you wouldn't be president. He said, yeah, I know. Everybody tells me the same thing.
And they're all right.
And they were all correct. So, yeah, of course he did. And as you may remember, the one of the issues that seemed to make the difference, and because the election was so close, every single thing that made the difference was it, he issued, while he was a candidate, a statement saying that President Eisenhower could have done a great deal for eliminating discrimination in housing with a stroke of the pen. It so happened when I got into the White House, people reminded the president by sending pens. I had more damn pens in my office than I knew what to do with. And the president did indeed issue the executive order on housing.
Well, joining us now also here in Studio 3A is Roger Wilkins, a former assistant attorney general in the Johnson administration. And Roger Wilkins, good to see you again.
It's nice to see you. Thank you.
And as we're talking about the Reverend King and the presidency, you, of course, dealt with him from a strange perspective in the Justice Department. Of course, while you were there as well, in another part of the Justice Department, there was J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, first of all, let me say that you have surprised me and delighted me by not telling me that my friend Lee White was going to be here. Well, and I want to tell you that in talking about civil rights in the government, before I went to the Justice Department, I was in the Agency for the International Development. And I had a contact in the White House, and I just thought that President Kennedy was going too slow, and I'd always tell him, Ralph, his name is Ralph Dungan. Ralph, tell the president this, tell the president that. And finally he said, you know this stuff, I don't know this stuff. Write him a memo, I'll give it to him. A few days after I wrote this memo, terrified to criticize the president, I was summoned to the White House to see the president's counsel. Very elevated human being, the White House counsel. And I walked in to see Mr. White,
mm-hmm.
who looked at me kindly and gently as if I were the village idiot, and he said, do you really believe that John Kennedy doesn't care about civil rights? And I said, yes, sir, I believe that. That is a true story.
As distinguished as the other ones you're going to tell.
You're right. So your question was?
Well, getting back to from the point of view of somebody who's in the movement, yes, there are people like you in the Justice Department and the Johnson administration who might be seen as allies. At the same time, J. Edgar Hoover was still running the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover was busily investigating people for all kinds of things, as we later learned out.
You could, when I was in the Justice Department, you could only surmise it. You could only believe that there was some proof somewhere that Hoover was doing things that the administration, that really were at odds with what the administration was trying to do. I did know that Hoover did not like my organization. It was a small community services agency, lots of blacks and a few Latinos, and people dressed the way people dressed in those times. Hoover sent a memo to the White House saying that I was running a black power cell in the Department of Justice. you knew that he had a fixation on communism, and you knew that his analysis of civil rights was laced with that obsession. What you didn't know, what I didn't know until late, was that he had a sicker obsession with Martin Luther King. And but Hoover and Hoover did not come to executive meetings of the Attorney General. I think he and I saw each other only twice.
Yeah. But for stepping outside of that for a moment, could you see as somebody looking inside of that, it's a little hard to figure out, are these people our friends or are they our enemies?
Oh, my assumption was that Hoover was our enemy, simply because he had the FBI had to be pushed and wiggled into work in the South on the Ku Klux Klan and the murders of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. John Doerr, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, had to devise a very brilliant but time-consuming kind of work sheet for his agents to follow in order to get information that we needed and that any good professional investigative organization would have done without being pushed. So we knew that there wasn't a friend in the house, in that house.
We're talking with Roger Wilkins, who served as Assistant Attorney General in the Johnson administration, Lee White, former Assistant Special Counsel to President Kennedy and former Special Counsel to President Johnson, about Martin Luther King and the presidents. Coming up next, we want to hear from you. If you were part of the civil rights movement, how did you view the role of government? Did you see it as an ally or as an obstacle or as both? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Martin Luther King Day, of course, and we're on this holiday talking about King's unique relationships with three presidents, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. Our guests here in Studio 3A were both eyewitnesses and participants, Roger Wilkins, Assistant Attorney General in the Johnson administration, Lee White, Assistant Special Counsel to President Kennedy, and then later Special Counsel to President Johnson. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. If you go back to those days, did you see the administration as an ally nor as an obstacle? 800-989-8255. And let me ask you, Lee White, when was it that Martin Luther King himself, you mentioned this group of people that of leaders that President Kennedy met with early on in his administration, but when was it that he started to notice Martin Luther King especially?
Well, there's an absolutely perfect answer to that. It was in August of 1963 in the March on Washington. And there were a number of fine speeches made. And all of a sudden, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. took the podium. And he offered one of the most remarkable speeches of all time. It's in the, I'm sure, in the anthology of great speeches. This was the March on Washington in August 1963. A couple of 100,000 people assembled on the mall in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And the administration was very antsy about this. We weren't all that comfortable about what was going to happen. So it was being monitored very carefully. As the program went on, I was in the Oval Office with President Kennedy, and all of a sudden we were watching the King speech. What a blockbuster. And that was the thing that propelled him out of the pack of leaders into a position of great influence in this country, and obviously much deserved. But it was that powerful speech, which we hear repeated frequently and which is should be, because it's one of the great turning points. And it also had the effect of putting Dr. King in a position where he could be a leader of the not only the black world, but the whole world in the United States, which led, of course, to the little rhubarb we have these days of who was more important in getting the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed. Well, it was a package. There was an inspiration, and there was a an implementer, a fellow who was very skilled at getting legislation enacted, and who, by the way, was used the assassination of President Kennedy as a ramming rod to push it through Congress, and he did, and it was a tribute to the martyred president.
Here's the clip that you're talking about, not Martin Luther King's clip. That's rather a long one, but this from Lyndon Johnson's speech to Congress.
No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long.
And in that moment when perhaps the tremendous political collateral that President Johnson had, nevertheless, this was not easy and not quick.
That's right. Well, Bobby Kennedy testified 9 days before Congress on that bill. But it was, things were rolling. And as President Johnson's skills were in very clear view. For example, he knew how to deal with Everett Dirksen, the minority leader from Illinois, a Republican from Illinois, minority leader in the Senate, and also Congressman McCulloch from Ohio, the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. And so he got some support from them, and he was prepared to share the credit as long as he got what he wanted, which was the passage of the 1964 Act. President Kennedy had an observation that seemed to me to be appropriate for some of the conversation we've had lately. He said, you know, defeat is an orphan, and success has 1,000 fathers. If we didn't worry too much about who got credit, we'd get perhaps more done.
I wonder, Roger Wilkins, you were, again, have another vantage point in that period of time. The urgency of now that Reverend King was talking about in 1963, you already said you've certainly felt that. Nevertheless, as you looked at those political difficulties faced by President Johnson, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I think that there was a huge difference between Presidents Kennedy and Johnson that, as a young man in his early 30s, I didn't really fully understand. The Kennedys were wealthy Bostonians, and they didn't know black people or poor people. It just wasn't in their frame of reference or in their lives. When Johnson became president, even though I'd been critical of President Kennedy, I was really distressed that this Southerner, I'd been born in the South and I grew up in the North, and I, hearing a Southern accent out of a white mouth always troubled me. And when Johnson acceded to presidency, I said to my uncle, who was running the NAACP at the time, oh, this is going to be terrible, the Southerner, da-da-da-da-da. He said, stop. He said, just stop. I know this man. I worked with him on the 1957 Civil Rights Act. I know his heart's in the right place, and I know he will lead us well. I took my uncle's judgment with several grains of salt. As I grew older, I understood that he was exactly right.
He got smarter. Yeah.
Johnson knew poor people as he was growing up. Johnson knew minority people as he was growing up. He knew their problems in ways that Kennedys could not have known their problems. And so what I experienced as a young person working for him was that despite my abhorrence of the war, that on every other front, my admiration for him just grew. Until after we were out of the government. And I ran into him several years after we were out of the government, and he said, well, how are you? And I said, fine. And he said, you're writing for the Post. That's a great thing to do. We need voices to speak up. I said, well, why don't you speak up, Mr. President? He said, do you think anybody would listen to me? He said, yes. I said, yes. If you spoke out, you'd have the second, you still have the second biggest voice in the country. He said, who could I get to help me? I said, get my Uncle Roy. You guys have known each other since the 50s. You, the same generation. You like each other. He said, that's a good idea. Sometime later, I learned that my uncle and his wife had been invited down to the Johnson Ranch. My uncle then told me when he got back that the president wanted ideas for speech and that they had had long conversations. Subsequently, as he was dying, the LBJ Library was opened and dedicated, and its civil rights papers were received. And against his doctor's advice and his wife's advice, Lyndon Johnson got up and he made what I consider to be the best civil rights speech made in the United States in the whole decade of the 70s. So his heart was right exactly where one would have wanted it to be.
There's another president we need to talk about, so we have another guest. David Nichols is the author of A Matter of Justice, Eisenhower and the Beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. He joins us from the studios of KNSS in Wichita, Kansas. David Nichols, nice to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And Eisenhower is not a name that most of us associate with the Civil Rights Movement. How much of a part of his domestic policy was it?
Well, it was a much more significant part than historians have granted to this point. Eisenhower desegregated the District of Columbia. He completed the desegregation of the armed forces that Truman had begun. He introduced the legislation that led to the 1957 Civil Rights Act. In fact, he introduced strong proposals that were largely gutted by the Southerners, including Lyndon Johnson. That was the first civil rights legislation in 82 years. Above all, Eisenhower appointed men to the Supreme Court and the federal courts who were pro-civil rights. On the Supreme Court, he appointed five men, including Earl Warren and William Brennan and Potter Stewart, men like that, and strong pro-civil rights judges in the South, like Frank Johnson, who dealt with the issue in Alabama with the Alabama the bus boycott and the 1965 Selma marches. Eisenhower did a lot more than he's been given credit for.
If we fail to give him credit, at least that's in no small part because he didn't speak much about it.
Well, speaking was not the thing, and this is the thing you have to do with Eisenhower, is look at what he did, not what he said. As a soldier, he had not won the war in Europe by making speeches, and sometimes, particularly black leaders, were very disappointed in him that he didn't make fervent speeches, and that includes Martin Luther King, who, as a very young man, interacted quite a bit with Eisenhower in the 50s. Do you want me to talk about that a little bit?
Well, if you could keep it short.
Yeah, Eisenhower proposed the civil rights legislation in 1957, and King immediately, with his new SCLC organization, put pressure on the president and on the Congress to pass that. They actually had a march in Washington in 1957. They called it a prayer pilgrimage. It was to celebrate the third anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education decision, King later told Richard Nixon that he supported even the weak bill that finally got passed. Most of the teeth got taken out of it by the Southerners and Lyndon Johnson, but he said it was still better than no bill at all. But they would have to have a mass movement to keep the legislation meaning anything. And that mass movement had not yet developed in the 50s, but it did in the 60s, as your guests have already talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yet, at the same time, legislation, executive actions, those sorts of things, certainly the appointment of judges is very important. On an issue of morals and conscience, words are important, too.
Well, they certainly are. And that's a legitimate criticism of Eisenhower. But I have to say, Eisenhower, if he didn't make a passionate appeal for a moral case on Brown v. Board of Education after 1954, neither did Lyndon Johnson, Harry Truman, or John F. Kennedy. You know, the thing I would emphasize here, and Michael Beschloss, your introduction to the program is exactly right, that actually the government took a backward step when Kennedy came into office in 1961. Eisenhower would never appoint segregationist judges in the South. Kennedy appointed a number of them. He and Lyndon Johnson really were very conservative on this issue until 1963. And then I give them full credit. They took great steps in mid-1963, 64, and 65, and did some wonderful things. But Eisenhower was actually more progressive than they were until that time.
We're talking about King and the Presidents. David Nichols is with us. He wrote A Matter of Justice, Eisenhower, and the Beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. Our other guests are Roger Wilkins, who served as Assistant Attorney General in the Johnson administration, Lee White, who served as Assistant Special Counsel to President Kennedy and Special Counsel to President Johnson. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get some callers involved in the conversation. And let's turn first to Tesfaye. Is that right?
Yes, Tesfaye.
Tesfaye, calling from Phoenix, Arizona. That I can pronounce. Go ahead, please.
Yes. On the outset, I like to say I'm neither a Republican nor a former supporter of Richard Nixon. But I'm glad you got the Eisenhower man online, because Richard Nixon wrote all kind of supporting letters and support for the civil rights movement way before the Kennedys. And knowing that his support would hurt him politically, and later on in the and I lived this history, later on in the 1960s, African Americans benefited a lot more from the Nixon administration than they did from the Johnson administration. However, in the end, when he realized he's not getting black support, he was in a good Nixon fashion. He devised the Southern strategy with John Mitchell. Incidentally, before I hang up, I like to say that we should all take what Bill Clinton is saying about Obama in the same fashion we interpret his statement regarding sex with Monica Lewinsky.
Well, thank you for that. But let's discuss what the matters that are on topic. And David Nichols, is he right about Richard Nixon?
Well, I can mainly speak about the 50s when Nixon was vice president. Nixon was progressive, but, you know, we have to get used to how different it was in those days, where particularly Northeastern Republicans were highly progressive on civil rights, whereas the Democratic Party was so badly split because of the solid Democratic South. But Nixon often was Ike's bully pulpiteer, I guess you could say. He was the one who spoke out politically on issues, and that was typical of Eisenhower and the way he utilized people. Nixon became fairly close to Martin Luther King. They met together on a meeting on June 13, 1957, for a long meeting, and Nixon later reported to the president that he thought he would really appreciate meeting with King. And in fact, in 1958, June 23, 1958, there was a significant meeting, and King caused this to come about more than anybody else, with Lester Granger and A. Philip Randolph and Roy Wilkins, all met with the president. This was a historic meeting of black leaders meeting with the president to talk policy. It wasn't just a photo op. They really got together to talk policy. Now, in fairness, Eisenhower was very reluctant to have that meeting, but King really pushed him into it, and King was only 29 years old at that time, so he was an extraordinary influence already.
Okay. Lee White, I just wanted to get your general reaction to David Nichols' broader point that until 1963, in fact, race relations took a step back when Kennedy took office.
Yeah, well, I was waiting for the opportunity to respond. I was about to say something nice about President Eisenhower that you didn't say, Mr. Nichols, and he had the guts to send the army into Little Rock, Arkansas. Now, that took a lot of guts for him, and I want to give him credit for that.
Yes, it did.
As far as President Kennedy, I hope I was making the point that he did an awful lot by executive order. We weren't stepping backward. We were stepping forward. And each president is, in my view, more closely compared to his predecessor. And the attitude was when President Kennedy, the young guy, took over from the old guy, was in the black community, here is a kindred soul. And they knew that they were in a happy house when they met with him. It's true that we didn't move as fast as they would like, but nobody would move as fast as some interest group would like, and this was the most powerful interest group in the country. So a lot was accomplished, and I just wanted to make sure the record was clear on that.
And if you want to find out more about what was accomplished in the Eisenhower administration, A Matter of Justice, Eisenhower and the Beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, David Nichols, thanks very much for your time today. We'll continue with more of your calls for our guests and the opinion page. This is NPR News. In a few moments, our regular opinion page weekly segment, but first we want to continue our conversation about King and the presidents. Our guests include Roger Wilkins, former Assistant Attorney General in the Johnson administration, and Lee White, a former Assistant Special Counsel to President Kennedy, former Special Counsel to President Johnson, and author of Government for the People, Reflections of a White House Counsel to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email us talk at npr.org. And Dave is on the line. Dave calling us in Boston.
Hi. I'll give you an anecdote that illustrates a little of what you've been talking about. I worked in the office that organized the 1963 March on Washington. It was Bayard Rustin was the main person responsible. And pardon my memory here, but early in the process, somebody from the Kennedy administration called up. I guess they spoke to Bayard, and they strongly urged him not to do it. They said, you know, don't come down here and make trouble. We'll resist it all we can. And by later in the summer, around the end of July or beginning of August, we had chartered every bus in the Northeast. And somebody else from the administration called up and said, gee, well, President wants you to know we're glad you're coming down to support his program. I think this reinforces the point that several people have made, that this wasn't a top-down process. This was really a bottom-up process, and it was caused by, you know, it was motivated by people in the streets, whether people on the top were forced or empowered to do something. I don't think it really matters. It was really the movement at the bottom that caused it. And I think we can see a lot of parallels in what's happening now, is that the general population is ahead of their so-called leaders.
I wonder, Lee White, was that your memory of that? Did it shift in that manner? Or
well, I don't know who Bayard Rustin talked to who told him not to come. That would be a very tough thing. It is true that the administration did not generate the project. It was from the leadership who said we should come. But
the civil rights leadership.
The civil rights leadership, yes. And that made sense. But what the administration had to do was to prepare for it and to make sure that it came off as smoothly as it could. And it did. Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, appointed Assistant Attorney General John Douglas, the son of former Senator Paul Douglas, as the point man to do whatever has to be done logistically. And the military had troops stationed around the city perimeter to, in the event that we didn't know it was going to happen. Today, our Washington police force is much more sophisticated than it was back in 1963. And so, as a responsible administration, we had to be alert to the problems that might flow. But the gentleman is correct that it was bottom up, it was not the administration's doings. And it turned out to have gone so smoothly that everybody heaved a sigh of relief.
And those thousand fathers then came out of the woodwork.
The thousand fathers came out of the woodwork. Correct. Every one of us said, yeah, we were all for it.
Thanks very much for the call, Dave.
All right, thanks.
So long. And Roger Wilkins, I want to ask you, in a way, you had a feat in both camps. Did you feel ambivalent about your role in government at all?
Very much. I was... As I said, when I was in the foreign aid program, I was very critical of President Kennedy and his stand. And I also, I have to say, just an aside about President Eisenhower, I accept everything that was said about him. But the issue that really concerned black people in the 50s was the Brown decision. And whether the Brown decision would be implemented, enforced, and what the mood of the country was in terms of accepting this new paradigm. And we all, I clerked for Thurgood Marshall during the summer of 1955 when I was still a law student. What we all wanted was a ringing affirmation from the White House that this was the law of the land. The Supreme Court had spoken. This is what the Constitution requires. And I, President Eisenhower, expect you to receive this peacefully and constructively. Mm. That never came. What came from the White House were suggestions that the president's silence indicated that he was unhappy with the decision. He did send troops to Little Rock, but that was about insubordination by a governor with respect to the dealing with the National Guard. And he had to do it as chief law enforcement officer, but as head of state, what he could have done to support Brown v. Board was, in the view of the young Roger Wilkins and the very old Roger Wilkins, a great, great error.
David Nichols, to be fair, also pointed out that neither President Kennedy nor President Johnson made that speech you're talking about.
Well, that's not quite correct. They weren't president when the decision was issued. And I don't know that they didn't say. In fact, I'd have to search the record, but I can't believe that certainly President Kennedy would have said he approved of that decision. I don't know where Mr. Nichols got that information, but that's something that ought to be examined.
Okay. Let's get one last caller in. This is Barbara. Barbara with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes. My husband and I were in Washington, D.C. in 1963. He was stationed in the Air Force, and we were so impressed with that beautiful speech of Dr. King's that when we moved back to Milwaukee, that still was resonant in our heart. And my husband and I marched with Father James Grappi and the people of Milwaukee that were for open house and for fair housing and civil rights, and we were photographed. They photographed us each time we marched, and we also felt that our phones were tapped. And so I didn't feel much support from the government, the people of the government of Milwaukee. It was definitely a bottom-up process. It definitely was something that came from the people.
Thank you very much for that. Appreciate the phone call. And Roger Wilkins, again, this sounds like it was local rather than federal, but nevertheless, people often saw the government as an adversary in this entire enterprise.
I think that even though there were some of us who thought that the Kennedys were slower than they should be, we always felt that they were on our side and moving in the right direction. And in fact, by 1963, President Kennedy was saying things that were very powerful and very constructive. From the beginning of his term in office, President Johnson, starting with making President Kennedy's death the occasion for passing a civil rights bill in his honor, and then he just pressed on and on and on. And it was quite clear where his heart was. As to the problem with the government, Father Grappi...
in Milwaukee, an activist.
In Milwaukee, a very activist priest, for whom people in the movement, Black People Movement, had high regard, was regarded by the FBI as a difficult and perhaps subversive person. I remember this very clearly because when Father Grappi brought a group of people from Milwaukee to the Poor People's Campaign, which Martin King had started and then was murdered before he was able to lead it, one of the warnings that came out of the FBI about the Poor People's Campaign and the people who were coming was a warning about Father Grappi and his radical Wisconsin group. And so I think your caller probably was not being paranoid. I suspect that there probably were people taking her picture.
We wanted to thank you both very much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day. Roger Wilkins, former Assistant Attorney General in the Johnson administration, and now teaches history at George Mason University. And also with us, Lee White, author of Government for the People, Reflections of a White House Counsel to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. They both joined us here in Studio 3A, and we thank them very much for your time. Coming up next, the Opinion Page.